for the past 4 decades. Meanwhile, most people are entirely unaware of the specifically military genealogy of these technologies. Rather, the prevailing narrative has been that Bay Area visionaries brought personal computing into our home, supposedly for purely altruistic reasons or some sort of spiritual liberation. People were drunk with techno-utopian narratives. Futurists would proselytize that information wants to be free and cyberspace would supposedly be the ultimate democratizing force that would level the playing field because information is power and all that emancipated information would lift us all up to new heights of empowerment. That was in the 1990s where we heard all those slogans. You couldn't hear a bad word about tech if your life depended on it. Needless to say, regulation was considered anti-enlightened and was looked upon with no less disdain than if someone in the room had loudly passed gas. After about a decade into the millennium, the bloom started to go off the rose. Online addiction became a thing. The internet was causing teen depression. Websites, most notoriously Facebook, throttled up extraction of our information to sell and monetize. Big tech had coalesced into a few powerful monopolies that paid next to nothing in taxes and wages, while the diverse economy shriveled into concentrated profits for Silicon Valley. Nonetheless, it is still considered somewhat blasphemous to suggest that perhaps technology is the problem, not the solution. Most people can't bear the notion that perhaps certain values are inherent and inseparable from the technology itself. They want to believe that technology is neutral. Like a knife, they rationalize, technology is a value-neutral tool that can be used for either good or evil, depending on the user's intent. You know, it's the old guns don't kill people, people kill people argument. Similarly, they believe that the internet was also just a neutral tool that can be used for either good or evil. They believe that the techno-utopians who built the first computers and sold us on them were too helpless, hopelessly idealistic and naive to foresee that one day the greedy capitalists would one day hijack it for their own evil ends. My second husband, may he rest in peace, Jerry Mander, gives a great example of how certain values are inherent in a technology. For example, he compares solar power to nuclear power, and I quote, "The existence of nuclear energy and nuclear weaponry in turn requires the existence of what Ralph Nader has called a new priesthood, a technical and military elite capable of guarding nuclear waste products for the approximately 250,000 years that they remain dangerous. So if some future society, tiring of the present path, should determine to move away from a centralized technological society and towards, say, an agrarian society, it would be impossible. The technical elite would need to remain, if only to deal with the various wastes left behind. So it is fair to say that nuclear energy inherently steers society toward greater political and financial centralization and greater militarization. Solar energy, on the other hand, is intrinsically biased toward democratic use. It is buildable and operable by small groups, even by families. It does not require centralized control, and it has no 250,000-year commitment from society, or doesn't require it," end quote. So whereas solar energy can operate at human scale and be passively collected, nuclear requires industrial scale operation, centralized control, and is undemocratic to future generations. These inherent attributes reflect the ideological bias within each technology. Consequently, technology that is derived from values of war and domination will inevitably proliferate those values. Technology is not value neutral. One of the best analyses I've come across on the inherent properties of technology has come from the French philosopher Jacques Ellul. Ellul coined the term la technique to describe how a society's technologies are part of a seamless fabric inseparable from political and economic structures, behavior, and thought. To go deeper, technology is not just a cell phone or just a drone or just an algorithm or just a nuclear bomb. No, technology is a whole way of thinking. It's a way of organizing society, a way of organizing our institutions, a way of being. It is systemic. Algorithm technologies specifically accelerate, amplify, and perpetuate the values of the Pentagon, which gave them birth. These military values are identical to those of capitalism, neoliberalism, colonialism, and globalism, among others. Algorithm technologies are the message, Marshall McLuhan would say, while Paul Edwards would say they are the metaphor. So I've thought about this a lot. It's been 40 years, and I've come up with four operative aspects particular to algorithm technologies that make them uniquely suited for war and totally inappropriate for a fair and just civil society. Those traits are, number one, scalability, number two, morphability, number three, networkability, and number four, invisibilization. These cornerstones of digital technologies synergize with one another to enable algorithms to take any form and work at any scale and speed while conforming to a preordained networked hierarchy. These are all the conditions needed to create a Cold War, closed world. Understanding these underpinnings of digital technologies' illusions of omnipotence is fundamental to resisting its built-in agenda of centralized control, domination, ceaseless growth, surveillance, and endless extraction. So number one, scalability. So a scalable system is one that handles rapid changes to task loads and user demands. Hegemony by force relies on the capacity to instantly communicate and strike in multiple places at varying moments at a global scale. That's why they ship the THAAD rocket launchers to Israel. Unfettered scalability is equally important for capitalistic endeavors, another kind of hegemonic pursuit, if you will. Only through digital technology's inherent scalability can a company like Amazon coordinate all the jets, drones, robots, trucks, data server farms, energy supplies, warehouse labor, AI, satellites, etc., to provide billions of global customers with next day delivery. The elephant in the room problem with a civilization built on scalability is that scalability implies endless growth. You can't have endless growth and endless extraction and endless waste on a finite planet. Hundreds of billions of dollars are being firehosed into AI investments, which promise to foster an acceleration of endless growth in the next century. In fact, one could say that AI is now the U.S. economy, and that includes military, which may be why stabs at regulation are so feeble and unmotivated. But you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see that Mother Earth cannot meet the insatiable and ever-increasing demands of energy, water, land, and extraction by an economy structured to be scalable. Endless growth, it's not found in nature, except as a cancer. We really should take heed. Okay, number two, morphability. Like scalability, morphability is also a superpower unique to digital technology. Morphability enables a user to manipulate any aspect of an object to their will and to even generate new forms. Morphability requires everything in the world to first be formatted by digitization from the terrain of the planet, the ocean floor, even the world's DNA, even our behavior patterns, and the movement of our thoughts. Digitization breaks down all of this material into small components, assigns a value, and then integrates it into code, which is then manipulatable through computing to mix and match with each other. It's sort of like word processing, but everything processing. Once it's in the database, it's up for grabs to be morphed into anything. You want to cross an ear of corn with a biological weapon? How about grow brain cells in a lab to function as an AI model? Or how about morphing millions of videos to falsely incriminate a presidential candidate? Anything can be morphed into most anything else with digital technology. Morphability creates illusion, reconnaissance, and surveillance instruments. These are stalwart tools in military strategy, you know, decoys. When this technology is applied to civil society, we see GMO vegetables posing as real food, online petitions that actually extract our information, surveillance instruments that people think are their telephones, and many, many other examples. Because this technology is inherently deceptive, its use as the operating system for modern civilization flies in the face of truth, justice, liberation, and democracy. Number three, network ability. Networks are comprised of the sensors, communication satellites, network connectivity, and data servers that do cloud computing. They endow digital technologies with the unique capacity to aggregate knowledge en masse into a new kind of super omniscience through these networks. Nothing could be more valuable for war strategy. In the last few years, for example, the U.S. has overhauled its warfighting capabilities to put front and center a globally networked, cloud-based command and control center overseen by the Space Force and built jointly by Amazon, Google, Oracle, and Microsoft. It enables the ability to summon at once unmanned military forces to rain terror down on any spot in the world, a swarm of drones, hypersonic missiles, submarine torpedoes, bombers, and all with the ease of calling an Uber. Same technology. This produces an unprecedented centralization of control in the hands of a tiny minority of individuals. Those who control this technology control the world. It doesn't help that the technology itself is constructed to externalize moral issues or environmental concerns. Network ability in combination with digital technology's other operative characteristics can extract, aggregate, and process people's data at a scale and speed that results in automated massacres of the lavender AI variety in Gaza. Its civilian counterpart imposes its own serious injustices in the realms of privacy, labor, copyright, and human rights. Over the last several decades, network ability has enabled businesses like Uber and Airbnb to disrupt entire industries and operate at hegemonic global scale. Add robot taxis and trucks to the mix and watch millions of drivers lose work. But if you think that's disruptive, just wait until the so-called Internet of Things is fully optional. The Internet of Things is networked together with all the smart machines, and it changes all the rules of the game. The Internet of Things extracts our data and runs that data through infinite operations that further concentrate power in the hands of the tech barons. We're starting to see the smart cities and smart farming, smart factories, smart grids, smart transportation, and so forth. At one time, it was we who used the tools. Now that the tools have been made smart, it's the tools that are using us. Number four, invisibilization. Algorithms are not built to operate holistically by any stretch of the imagination, let alone to take relationality into consideration. They're built to assess, discriminate, produce a winner and a loser. They are inherently exclusionary. Jairus Grove, a professor at the University of Hawaii, gives an engaging interpretation of the so-called double-click theory put forth by French philosopher Bruno Latour. He describes how the internet curates experience. It controls where we go seamlessly, where not knowing is the norm. It is not a stretch to see how how such thinking is ideal for military culture in which authority must be followed unquestioningly. No details other than those which are part of one's orders are allowed to be known. Grove says, quote, "You're on the internet, moving your cursor around almost as seamlessly as if it were your finger. A hyperlink shows up and you click on it. But the thing about the double click when you follow that link is precisely the way that hyperlink works. It's intended for you to forget, for you to be incapable of knowing what came before it. How did you get from point A to point B? Why did you choose that particular link? We have a particular kind of technology here, which by definition reads a kind of forgetting, a kind of not knowing, and a kind of thoughtlessness," he says, end quote. In other words, there are inherent properties of the technology which prevent the dots from being connected into a holistic whole. Now, that's great for command and control in war, but it's a disaster for critical thinking and human civilization. Grove widens the metaphor of curated experience from mere internet surfing to include the zero-sum game logic that drives the pursuit of hegemony at the global scale. Zero-sum game means only the stories of certain people and places can remain in full view at the expense of other people and places who are invisibilized. The dichotomy of Israel and Palestine is a perfect example of how an elaborate narrative of Israel's history, showcasing the Holocaust and the escape from anti-Semitism, is well established in the collective consciousness, while the story of Palestine has been all but erased. The stilted curation in the Western media has continued throughout the many months of genocide. Genocide, it's a word, it's not even allowed to be uttered in the mainstream media. I mean, you can say the seven dirty words canonized by George Carlin, but you can't say genocide. Imagine. Now, that is invisibilization. The most existentially crucial invisibilization by digital tech is that of the natural world. Digital technologies operate unbounded by time or geography. Rather, they're a function of topology, which flouts the authority of time and space, the very currency of the natural world. Geographies and cycles comprise the operating system for the intricate web of life. The seasons, the ebb and flow of tides, sunrise, sunset, systole and diastole, countless other rhythms. We ignore them at our peril. Sacred cycles and places have been scripture since time immemorial for indigenous societies, instructing when and how to plant, to fish, to harvest, to give birth, to bury one's dead. But the inherently invisibilizing properties of digital technologies run roughshod over these ancient guideposts. Algorithms trample constraints of season or space, working ceaselessly 24/7 to buy and sell on world stock markets, to secure deals, to cut down forests, extract commodities on all continents and seabeds, till agrochemical farms with satellite-driven robots, and displace traditional sustainable communities which had survived for millennia due precisely to their respect for cycles and geographies. Nature may hold no currency in the digital realm, but Mother Earth bats last. When a civilization embraces a technology that flouts nature, it's doomed. So fast forward to today, 2024. It's been 40 years since my year with the computer science nerds and trillions of American tax dollars into research and testing for missile defense. We're now living a nightmare that was once only a vision on the drawing boards at Carnegie Mellon. The escalating bloodbaths in the Middle East are real. This is the same missile technology that has been installed throughout Asia and the Pacific in preparation for war with China, another self-fulfilling prophecy. In fact, the wars in the Middle East and Ukraine are the unregulated testing grounds to develop protocols to be used in a wider high-tech war with China. With that in mind, I've been paying special attention to the Iron Dome's effectiveness in deflecting attacks from Hezbollah and Hamas. In April, you'll recall, Iran and Hezbollah fired hundreds of missiles and drones at Israel. 99% of all those attacks were intercepted. It was ostensibly a testament to the superior technology of lead manufacturer Raytheon, or so the story goes. What the Western media didn't reveal, what it had double-clicked past, was that this was actually a tactical victory for the Iranians. Iran had made the calculated decision to cast as many projectiles at Israel as possible, not to necessarily penetrate its elaborate defense system, but rather to deplete the arsenal and consequently topple Goliath by his own weight. At that, they succeeded brilliantly. Estimates of how much the US and Israel jointly blew through that night range from $1 billion to a whopping $4 billion in a few hours. It was like smashing a roach with a Rolex. I mean, to boast about Iron Dome's effectiveness in those terms is like lighting money on fire and bragging about how bright it is, to quote the blogger Indrajit Samarajiva. The story shifted after Iran's more recent attack on October 1st. It was not necessarily intercepted by Israel. Iran fired approximately 200 missiles. A key Israeli airbase was struck. They were not the short-range Hamas-style rockets. These were sophisticated ballistic hypersonic missiles. Hypersonic missiles cruise above the atmosphere undetected and then shoot down from high in the sky at a very steep angle, often in erratic movements that make them impossible to intercept because their trajectory is unpredictable. I repeat, there is no way to intercept a hypersonic missile. So, regardless of the success rate of missile defense, there is no winning, even from a warmonger's point of view, because when interception is successful, it is a deep loss to taxpayers. $4 billion in one night, money that should go to education, healthcare, teachers, infrastructures, and other domestic needs, instead goes to replenishing costly interception missiles. In Asheville, North Carolina, where terrible floods and mudslides have struck, people are still pleading for help. This is where American taxes should be going, not to be replacing Israel's arsenal. And when interception is not successful, the loss is, of course, obvious. People are maimed and killed, towns are reduced to rubble, forests burn, and the conflict escalates. But either way, the AI designers and the missile manufacturers make out like bandits. All this spending on high-tech weapons, it reminds me of something that Jairus Grove told me. He said that the rush to replace human soldiers with missiles, drones, and robots was motivated by the goal of normalizing endless war and its continual profits. The logic goes, as long as there's no human casualties, there'd be no public pressure to end wars. Endless war means endless profits for Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, NVIDIA, and the whole band of sleazy thugs. These weapons were not developed for defense at all, actually. They were developed to incur profit. They involve highly sophisticated, very costly technologies with very high profit margins. The systems were sold without ever being tested, installed, and they never even worked. The idea of defense, it's an afterthought. As Julian Assange observed years ago about the war in Afghanistan, the goal is not to completely subjugate Afghanistan. The goal is to use Afghanistan to wash money out of the tax bases of the United States, out of the tax bases of European countries through Afghanistan and back through the hands of a transnational security elite. That is the goal, i.e., the goal is to have endless war, not successful war. End quote. The profound tragedy, of course, is that they're playing with thousands and thousands of human lives. Assange was speaking long before the Pentagon went full bore into AI, robotics, autonomous weapons, and Star Wars missiles. Now, the money made off these new high-tech weapons make the $2 trillion spent on tanks and choppers deployed in Afghanistan over 20 years look like peanuts. Missile defense may be the biggest, longest-running, most morally bankrupt public scam in human history. The algorithms that it sired have been a scourge on Mother Earth and our own humanity. With our smartphones, satellites, robotics, AI, nuclear power, and all the rest, civil society has unwittingly become militarized through and through. But along with all this dubiously impressive technology, dubiously, missile warfare has accelerated the franchising of carnage overseas as systematically as it has vaporized the tax base at home. Thank you.
You were just listening to Kuhan Pakmander on algorithms, digital technologies, and warfare. Kuhan Pakmander is a journalist, author, and peace and environmental activist. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Francesca Albanese, Naomi Klein, Chris Hedges, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Kuhan Pakmander on algorithms, digital technologies, and warfare, and for Noam Chomsky's classic book, Letters from Lexington, Reflections on Propaganda, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. PDFs and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Underrepresented music, local voices, and real people. You keep CJSF independent.
This is Bird Note. Cackling geese may look a lot like Canada geese, but their slighter build and shorter beaks give them away as a distinct species. And one subspecies in particular has a very special story. Aleutian cackling geese build their nests on a chain of islands off the western coast of Alaska. In the 1700s, fur traders introduced an invasive species of fox to the islands, with devastating consequences for the geese. For decades, Aleutian cackling geese were believed to be extinct. But in the 1960s, a biologist discovered a group of around 300 birds nesting on Boldeer Island. The fortuitous discovery allowed conservationists to put the birds on the endangered species list. And this paved the way for federal protections on their Alaskan nesting grounds and their wintering territories in Oregon and California. Thanks to this habitat conservation, there are now more than 120,000 Aleutian cackling geese making the biannual journey between Alaska and the Gulf of Mexico. To learn how to conserve seasonal habitats and protect the future of migratory birds in your area, start at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mark Bramhill.